From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
AIDS in South Africa threatens our humanity. It affects poor people, it affects black people, it affects gay people, and it will reverse the gains of democracy over the last few years.
Today, a discussion about AIDS in Africa. Also, a debate. The South African president has opened a discussion on whether HIV causes AIDS. We'll have a roundtable discussion with a South African AIDS activist, an Africa expert, two scientists, and a journalist who just won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on AIDS in Africa. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Vermont House of Representatives yesterday passed a bill granting the full benefits of marriage to same-sex couples, making enactment of the most sweeping gay partnership law in the United States a virtual certainty. We now go just to outside Montpelier to reporter David Goodman, who was in the State House yesterday.
The packed Vermont State House was once again the scene of an emotional, climactic debate on whether or not to extend the rights and benefits of marriage to gay and lesbian couples yesterday, with supporters and opponents of same-sex unions ringing the galleys, filling the hallways, and praying outside on the steps of the State House. The 150-member Vermont House of Representatives voted for the third and final time on a bill that would legalize civil unions between gay and lesbian couples. The bill passed 79-68. The civil unions law will provide same-sex couples with all marital rights enjoyed by heterosexual couples. These include inheritance rights, the right to visit a partner in the hospital and make medical decisions for a partner, and family leave benefits. But civil unions, while constituting the most comprehensive gay rights legislation in the nation, fall short of marriage. As a result of the Defense of Marriage Act signed by President Clinton in 1996, same-sex unions will not be entitled to federal benefits, which include Social Security and veterans benefits, and the unions may not be recognized by other states. Nevertheless, gay and lesbian activists in Vermont celebrated the civil rights milestone in the chamber of the House and in conversations and parties that lasted into the evening yesterday. The bill now goes to Governor Howard Dean, who has said he will sign the bill into law within the week, and civil unions will become a reality on July 1st. For Democracy Now!, this is David Goodman in Montpelier, Vermont.
In this news from Santiago, Chile, on the eve of a crucial court session on whether General Augusto Pinochet should be immune from prosecution, the former dictator said through an aide he had no hand in killings during his regime. In a closed-door session today, the 21 judges of Santiago Court of Appeals are to receive the report of an investigating judge who wants Pinochet's congressional immunity lifted so he can face trial. According to a government report, more than 3,000 people were killed or disappeared during Pinochet's 17 years in power. This news from Buenos Aires. Three former Argentine military officers have reportedly been detained as authorities investigate the disappearance of 30 political prisoners during Argentina's past military regime. A judge ordered the detentions of former Lieutenant Colonel Enrique Moner Ruiz, retired Major Gustavo Alsina, and retired Sergeant Miguel Angel Perez, according to the National News Agency. The retired officers were spit upon and insulted as they were led before the federal judge, 475 miles northwest of Buenos Aires. A government report found that at least 9,000 people died or disappeared during a crackdown on leftist opponents during the so-called Dirty War. Human rights groups say the figure could be as high as 30,000. And this news from Bolivia, where martial law has recently been lifted as a result of major protests against the privatization of water being pushed by the World Bank and in conjunction with the corporation Bechtel. A plainclothes sharpshooter filmed by a Bolivian television network as he fired bullets into crowds of water protesters last week has been identified as Captain Robinson Iriarte de la Fuente, a graduate of the U.S. Government School of the Americas, what many critics call the School of the Assassins in Fort Benning, Georgia. According to the Andean Information Network, a human rights group, records show that he participated in a fall 1978 combat weapons course at the Fort Benning, Georgia school. The Indiana State Police has disputed a report that alleges a group of white supremacist prison employees used violence and racial epithets to intimidate inmates and their colleagues. A state police investigation found no evidence that such a group exists, but a 2.5-year study by DePaul University's Russell Compton Center for Peace and Justice released yesterday claims a racist group called the Brotherhood has operated for the past decade at Putnamville Correctional Facility, a medium security prison about 40 miles west of Indianapolis. According to the university report, some of the group's members openly supported Brotherhood tattoos and swastika rings, and one wore a KKK-style hood at work. And finally, racial tensions are being blamed for triggering a riot at a prison last night at La Mesa, Texas. One prisoner was killed and more than 24 were injured, some critically. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, at a summit held in the Nigerian capital to deal with growing health crises in Africa, African leaders agreed that the devastating death toll from malaria and AIDS in Africa calls for a total write-off of the continent's foreign debt to free resources to combat the twin scourges. AIDS has reached staggering proportions in sub-Saharan Africa, worse than in any other region in the world. According to United Nations estimates, 10 times as many people in Africa die from AIDS than die from war. Health systems are being placed under severe strain in Zimbabwe. More than half of all hospital patients are diagnosed with HIV. Teachers are dying, more than 4 a day in Zambia, 1 a day in the Ivory Coast. South Africa now has one of the fastest growing rates of HIV infection. 10% of South Africans are now believed to have the HIV virus, but very few have access to drugs like AZT. Vice President Al Gore generated heated criticism by AIDS activists here and in South Africa when he went to South Africa on behalf of U.S. drug companies and threatened the government with economic retaliation if they went ahead with plans to manufacture cheaper generic drugs. This has caused a very serious debate and response from African countries. South African President Thabo Mbeki has opened debate in recent months, a debate that includes whether HIV actually causes AIDS. He's also issued a harsh attack on the world's pharmaceutical industry and has called for a commission that will review the major assumptions about the epidemic. And Becky's office issued a statement last month condemning corporations that, quote, propagate fear to increase profits. He also said that, quote, the profit takers who are benefiting from the scourge of HIV/AIDS will disappear to the affluent beaches of the world to enjoy wealth accumulated from a humankind ravaged by a dreaded disease. Later in the program, we're going to have a discussion, a debate on HIV/AIDS, its causes, and what to do about it today. But before we do that, we're joined right now by Zaki Akhmat, who is a former anti-apartheid activist. He's a founding member of South Africa's National Coalition for Gay and Lesbian Equality and was a founder of the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa. Openly living with HIV, Zaki has been a staunch advocate for equality and treatment access. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Zaki Akhmat.
How are you, Amy?
And thanks for making the trip over. You just flew in yesterday. Let's look in South Africa at the chronology, starting, I guess, with President Nelson Mandela and how he has dealt with AIDS and the scope of the problem.
Amy, President Mandela has probably the only saint I know and the only religious conviction I have. On the 8th of March 1999, the government had organized a train, an AIDS awareness train, which traveled throughout the country, and it made its way through the country and ended in Cape Town on International Women's Day. At that day, the Treatment Action Campaign had organized a welcome for the president and other people, and to ask for AZT for pregnant mothers. When the president went to speak, one of the things he said as he started was the not prepared part of his speech. He said when he came from prison, he went to the northern province, and he, or one of the provinces which are predominantly rural, and he spoke to a group of 12-year-old kids, and he said to them, you must use condoms. This is after he'd been advised by the then Secretary General of our party, the ANC, Cheryl Carolus. And she said to him, you have to speak about AIDS. And he said to the kids, you must use condoms when you have sex. He said then afterwards that he was called aside by the traditional leaders and told not to speak about it again. This exact same thing was repeated in a predominantly white area in the Free State, which was an old Afrikaner stronghold. And the principal at that school told him, if you want to lose the next election, you have to speak about AIDS. And he said, I then stopped speaking about it. And look where we are today. And that sums up, in a certain manner, the approach that, unfortunately, our government has taken over the last six or seven years in our country. In 1994, a national AIDS plan was drafted, between 93 and 94, a national AIDS plan was drafted, which included all the trade unions, big business, NGOs, and the government, and all political parties. That plan was adopted by our previous Minister of Health, Dr. Nkosazana Zuma, who I miss sorely as a health minister, because she had a vision and she really knew what she wanted to get done. The plan was adopted, but A, the absence of resources, and B, I think the scale of the epidemic so threw people that we wanted a quick fix. And that quick fix, there are two areas in which that quick fix came about. The first was, of course, the Sarafina scandal, in which I don't know, for most people in the West who were actively involved in the anti-apartheid movement, there was something really tremendous when Mbungeni's and Ngema's play Sarafina won, conscientized millions of people across the world about what was happening in South Africa. And I think Dr. Zuma saw this as an occasion to conscientize millions of people in South Africa about AIDS and HIV. Unfortunately, the amount of money that was allocated for a single play was three times as much as all the money that was allocated for the NGO budget in the same period, and it was allocated to a single playwright and his company, and that caused a scandal.
To do what?
To raise awareness about HIV and AIDS.
A Sarafina Part 2 that would deal with AIDS.
It was exactly called that, Sarafina 2. And Sarafina 2, in terms of its content about HIV transmission, in terms of its understanding of young women and the problems I'm not a young woman at this stage, but the problems that young women face at home and in township South Africa, as many people know, has a very high incidence of violence against young women and also sexual violence against young women. And so from that point of view, I think it was a quick fix. The second quick fix came, and it's ironic how both the president at the moment and a number of ANC politicians who supported that industrial solvent for people with HIV called Viridine, was the second attempt at a quick fix at South African so-called scientists found a cure for AIDS, and that was an industrial solvent called Viridine. And regrettably, our president, who is a very smart man, put his weight behind it, and I'll quote from memory, and he said, it would be a mistake to deny any, and he used the word AIDS victim, and as a person with AIDS, I don't like that. A lot of us who are very PC don't like that term, AIDS victim, but anyway, he said, meaning well, it would be a mistake if AIDS victims, and I use these words, would be denied access to treatment because of costs and because of established financial interests. And I think that holds for people with AIDS. It's true in South Africa that at the moment we have approximately, according to government figures, survey South Africa is the best surveyed country on HIV and AIDS anywhere in Africa and in most of the world. We've had for the last 10 years regular surveys at our antenatal clinics throughout the country, and their projections now projections from taken from those surveys, and which have been confirmed by small sentinel studies. Mark will speak about those a little bit later, I'm sure. But sentinel surveys, that we now have between 3.5 and 4.5 million people in our country living with HIV, according to government estimates. And yet, the vast majority of us with HIV die lonely. You won't find more than 200 or 300, perhaps 400 people living openly with HIV within our country because of the stigma, because of the fact that you can lose your job, you can lose your home, you can lose your family. Personally, I have half my family not speaking to me. At the beginning of the year, in fact, I had a call from a cousin of mine who I don't know, because the other, her sisters who I did grow up with, don't speak to me. So the younger one, I don't know at all. And they phoned because they needed help. They found out that their sister had AIDS, and she had thrush, she had TB, and she couldn't eat, and the doctors told her, you have 1 month left to live. And she couldn't afford Diflucan, which we'll probably speak about later, the medication that Pfizer makes for esophageal thrush. She couldn't afford it. And I illegally imported the generic equivalent from Thailand, something which I would have paid for, that I did pay for myself, 5,000 Rand after friends gave me the money, the same amount for 450 Rand. And my cousin is walking around today. She's healthy. But the rest of the family will not speak to her. They have dumped her in a home for abandoned, they've dumped her in a hospice. So I think, just to sum up, the country faces a tremendous test of our humanity. And not only of that, but also of the resources. Because were we to treat all people with AIDS at current prices, it would exhaust not simply the health budget, but the entire government budget in our country.
Zaki Akhmat, an openly HIV-positive South African activist, AIDS activist, you've declared publicly you will not take antiretroviral medication until they're available in the public sector for poor people.
All my friends tell me I'm mad. My sister tries to speak to me about it every day. It's not an easy decision. I don't do it because I want to commit suicide, but I certainly believe that it would be a mistake to live in a world that lets people die simply because we are black and because we are poor. And I don't want to die, and I hope I'm not going to die, simply because I'm not taking medications. I firmly am convinced that we will be able, as activists, to mobilize sufficient pressure and public opinion, and that we will be able to change the mindset of drug companies and also of governments. I know the World Bank has just jumped onto the bandwagon and said money is no issue. I know that African dictators are calling for the scrapping of the debt to deal with AIDS, but clearly there are two things that need to happen. An accountability needs to be made for every cent spent on HIV and AIDS, because that money, a lot of that money, is going into conferences, into the pockets of bureaucrats on the one hand, and on the other hand, one has a situation where we don't want to make our countries indebted again to the World Bank and the IMF simply because we now have a new sexy disease going around that is attractive or to which pharmaceutical companies can dump onto the World Bank and make our countries pay again and again and again while we're having a disease which is ravaging the poor.
We're talking to Zaki Akhmat, who is an AIDS activist in South Africa. This summer, the World AIDS Conference will be taking place in Durban, South Africa. When we come back, we'll talk to a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, just won the prize for his reports on AIDS in Africa, Mark Schoofs. And we'll talk to a Ugandan scientist who's at Johns Hopkins. And we'll speak with two have come to be known as AIDS dissidents, people in this country who are actually speaking with South African President Thabo Mbeki about the issue of AIDS, what causes it, and what should be done about it. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Mark Schuf's just won the Pulitzer Prize for his series in the Village Voice, AIDS in Africa. It is a multi-part series where he went around the continent from Nigeria to Zimbabwe to South Africa and other countries dealing with the issue. Welcome to Democracy Now! And congratulations,
Mark. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Can you talk about the series and what you wanted to accomplish with it?
Well, what I wanted to accomplish is that when I originally thought of the series, here in the United States, we have these drugs that combat AIDS, which have been remarkably successful in reducing the death rate in across the developing world. So all the rich countries have seen the death rate from AIDS plummet as a result of these drugs. And I was very afraid that the issue of AIDS would fall off the radar screen, that we would have a situation where here in America, where most of the biomedical research is conducted, that there would be less pressure for funding, less pressure to keep this disease on our agenda, even while most of the people who have HIV live in countries, as Tzaki so poignantly pointed out, where they cannot afford these life-saving medicines. And so I thought that I would try to do my part to expose the crisis of AIDS in the developing world. And I chose Africa because Africa has more people with HIV than any other part of the world. And so I went there basically to report on the situation.
And what did you find?
Well, I've been reporting on AIDS for 13 years. I've lost many people who are close to me. And even though I had done that, even though I had read other reports on AIDS in Africa, I was not prepared for the scale of devastation. Let me give you two examples. The first, of course, is the orphans. AIDS strikes people in the prime of their life, people who are in their healthiest, strongest, most productive years. And those people are very, very often parents. And so their children are, of course, orphaned. And almost always you find both the man and the woman dying because this is a sexually transmitted disease. And so the orphans are left with no parents. Now, what happens to those orphans? And in a rich country, there might be ways of handling this. Africa has a very strong, very vibrant, very connected, extended family. So what happens is that African grandmothers, or sometimes grandparents, if there are two still living, first of all, have to nurse their children as they die. And so the grief of actually losing your child when you yourself are at an old, frail age is one huge blow to these people. And then at, say, 70 years old or 65 or 75 or whatever age they happen to be, after nursing their own children till they die, they must then look after their grandchildren. And these people often, especially in the rural areas, are poor. They make their living by tilling the little plot of land that's by their hut. And because of the history of colonialism, those huts are often located on the least fertile land. And so they have to eke out a living by, as they say in Uganda, scratching the earth. And they have to eke out that living now not just for themselves in their old age, but for these children that they never thought that they were going to have to be looking after. Now, that's the situation that you have. You have the actual young orphans, and you have what I call the elderly orphans, these grandparents who are trying to help their grandchildren. But what happens now to those orphans? Because despite the best efforts of the grandparents and the extended family, those orphans, studies have repeatedly found, are more likely to be poor, less likely to be educated, more likely to have all of the abuse and emotional problems that will lead a person to have unsafe sex and acquire HIV. So those orphans themselves are at higher risk for HIV. And now, 20 years into the AIDS epidemic, you're seeing a second generation of orphans. Orphans having children and those children being orphaned. But now, there's no grandparents because the kids who are having these children are orphans. So the second generation of orphans, which we're just now beginning to see, will be even worse off than the first generation of orphans. So what we're seeing is a tremendous snowballing of problems in a continent that already has its plate full. So that, I think, to me, if you look at it at the family level and the micro level, that's the most devastating effect that AIDS is having in Africa. There are many others, but that is perhaps the most devastating.
The whole issue of the causes and treatments of AIDS has long been debated. Now, in recent years, the majority of people working in the field, including many activists, have come to the conclusion that the evidence is overwhelming that HIV is one of the major causes of AIDS, and that the newer generations of drugs developed in the mid-90s are powerfully effective in extending life of people with the disease. But in the last few months, this debate has been given new life, reopened, gotten a lot of attention when the South African president, Thabo Mbeki, began a dialogue with some of the people commonly known as AIDS dissidents, who question whether AIDS is a virus at all, or whether it's a combination of pre-existing diseases caused by social conditions like poverty, street drug use, or if even the very use of the medications that are being pushed to deal with AIDS are causing the problem. We're going to turn to this issue now, but before we do, I wanted to go back to this issue of the chronology of how it's been dealt with, particularly in South Africa, with Zaki Asmat. Zaki, you're an AIDS activist with South Africa's National Coalition for Gay and Lesbian Equality, and as well as the Treatment Action Campaign. I wanted to put this in the context of how Thabo Mbeki, the new president after Nelson Mandela, came to where he is now, starting with the drug controversy, the AIDS drugs. And President and Vice President Gore, we heard about it because ACT UP activists dogged him on the campaign trail, putting up signs that said, "Gore, greed kills." You were doing similar things in South Africa.
Amy, the first thing is, our president is the most powerful man in Africa today. He's powerful because he leads a movement that fought against colonialism and apartheid for most of the 20th century. And so when he speaks, people listen. But it is a real indictment of our government's AIDS policy that the most powerful man in Africa had not read the AIDS literature or started reading it until fairly recently. And he started at the wrong end. And that's a tragedy for us. And so when the debate started on AZT, it was started specifically on the question of whether AZT should be provided to pregnant women and to rape survivors, but particularly pregnant women in order to reduce mother-to-child transmission. And we campaigned and will continue to campaign for that. That is the Treatment Action Campaign. And what happened is the previous Minister of Health had a meeting with us and said cost is the only issue. We then raised, this is after we'd raised pressure on her, and we raised pressure against Glaxo Welcome, and we managed to push
Glaxo Welcome, which makes AZT.
And we pushed them into a corner to reduce the price of AZT. At the same time, a new drug, or not a new drug, but one of the antiretrovirals, which nevirapine, which is made by Boehringer Ingelheim, was much cheaper. It was 40 rand as opposed to 400 rand, so 10 times less, and much easier to administer, was found in Uganda to also reduce mother-to-child transmission. So what we're campaigning for is for those drugs to be made available. The minister's special advisor, Ian Roberts, kept on telling her that AZT is toxic, and that's why we're not providing it. This is the new minister again. The new minister, when asked by the president, why are we not providing, because he also picked up on the previous minister's argument, the only reason we're not providing is because it costs too much. He then picked up the argument, and apparently one night very late, he sat at his computer and typed in AIDS and toxicity. And when you do that, there's only one thing you're going to come up with, and that's Peter Duisberg. And our president is a very intelligent man. He loves to think of himself as someone who is influenced by science and not prejudice. And so he started reading this so-called dissident or discredited literature and came up with this argument. The problem is, this is not a Hardy Boys character who's trying to solve a health crisis. This is a president in a country with the highest number of people living with AIDS. This is a president who is much admired, and he is single-handedly setting back health policy within our country in relation to AIDS.
Actually, there's a longer history to this even than Thabo Mbeki, because I think that people need to realize that President Mbeki, you know, had to overcome apartheid for most of his life, and that is a very time-consuming, shall we say, as an understatement, effort. So this is a man who could not and did not follow AIDS carefully over the 20 or almost 20 years now, 19 years, that AIDS has been being researched in the literature. And these so-called self-styled AIDS dissidents have been making the same arguments for about 12 to 13 years. And they were taken very, very seriously by every scientist basically in the field when those arguments were first made. And they were conclusively debunked. Then again in 1993, the issue came up, and again it was taken seriously in all of the AIDS journals and debunked. And so now here's Thabo Mbeki, without any of this history, reading it for the first time.
Well, let's bring some of those people into this discussion. Dr. David Rasnick is with us, a biochemist who's worked in the pharmaceutical field for 22 years, recently a visiting scientist at University of California, Berkeley, worked on developing protease inhibitors. In fact, he and South African President Thabo Mbeki have talked on the telephone. Thabo Mbeki sent him a list of questions. Dr. David Rasnick, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Is Charlie Geschechter by...
he is also with us, yes.
I would suggest that maybe Charlie, since we've been talking about the African thing, maybe he should start talking first, because it's fresh in everybody's mind. I'm more than happy to talk about this AIDS stuff, but I think he could immediately address what Mr. Schuf's and Zaki were talking about, and then I can go into the distant stuff if you like.
Dr. Charles Geschechter is professor of African history at Chico State University in California, has been doing research in Africa since the 1960s, and recently met with the South African Minister of Health. Why don't you start off by laying out what it is that you discussed and talking about the international panel that the South African government wants to now set up to deal with a number of issues, including the causes of AIDS.
Well, good morning, Amy. It's good to be with you. I've been listening very closely to what's been said about HIV and AIDS in South Africa from Zaki and from Mark Schuf's. I've talked at length with Mark. In fact, I talked to him, as he well knows, at length a month or so ago when he was preparing a story about Thabo Mbeki's raising of questions with Dr. Rasnick and myself. I guess what I would urge from the very beginning is something like this. As a progressive and as an AIDS activist from California, the state where AIDS was born, so to speak, as a construct, is that we look, or that listeners look very closely at some of the language which is being used or has been used on this program, and stop and think about it. For example, one thing which is being said here is about the epidemic of AIDS in Africa. And I think it's important from the outset that we identify clearly exactly what it is we're talking about and what it is we're counting when we see these enormous numbers, and make a distinction between an AIDS case in Africa, as it would be found in, say, South Africa, versus an AIDS case as it is defined in California, because then you will realize that there's something slightly odd, if not fishy, here, which I think should be disconcerting, in that we have a syndrome, not a disease, but a syndrome, which in fact is defined differently on different continents. The definition of an AIDS case in Johannesburg or Pietermaritzburg or Cape Town or Babenango in rural KwaZulu-Natal is the following definition. If a person presents the following symptoms to a clinician or to a doctor or a public health official or a nurse, you have AIDS. If you have a high fever, a persistent cough, you have loose stools or diarrhea for 14 days, and you have suffered a 10% loss of body weight over a two-month period. If you have those symptoms, you, by definition, by the World Health Organization's definition, have AIDS. Now, if you ask me, are those symptoms widespread on the African continent? Are those symptoms increasing over the last 20 or 25 years? As someone who has worked in Ethiopia and Somalia and Kenya and recently visited South Africa, I would tell you absolutely that those symptoms of a fever, of a cough, of diarrhea, and of a weight loss most assuredly have been increasing across the African continent. But what a progressive would say is, what has caused, what are the institutional reasons that have caused that kind of a breakdown of a person's health? And a progressive position would clearly be to look at the nature of African political economies. understand the nature of international indebtedness, the policies of the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Now, I have had all of those symptoms every time I have worked in rural Somalia, an equatorial area, a desert area, lots of talcum powder kind of dust on the edge of the desert. But when I go on an airplane and I fly from Mogadishu back to San Francisco, I don't have AIDS anymore because I'm not an African. I am simply said to have traveler's diarrhea or something along those lines. So the tragedy that's unfolding in Africa, despite all of the very compassionate and very eloquent statements that we've heard from Mark Schuetz and from Zaki Akhmat, is that there has been a tragic misdiagnosis of what is making Africans sick and what we can do to restore them to their full health. The value of Thabo Mbeki, who, as Zaki and other South Africans have pointed out, is an extremely shrewd, intelligent social critic. What he has done has been to take the skills and the knowledge that served him so well when he was the one who initiated secretly the negotiations whereby the white supremacists of apartheid were wooed out of the arms of apartheid and into the arms of a fledgling multiracial democracy. Thabo is the one who led the ANC in exile in early negotiations with, of all people, Afrikaner dissidents, as all South Africans know by now, beginning in 1986 and 87. The ANC was born as a dissident organization. Thabo Mbeki doesn't go trawling the internet. It is such a libel to say that someone who is concerned about the health and well-being.
Sorry,
of
libel?
People,
how do you define libel?
I didn't, wait a minute, Zaki. I was perfectly silent when you talked, and I think it's very important that we all be allowed to
but
say.
But sir, you are. Excuse me, sir. Can I ask you? Can I make one point?
No, because
you are lecturing. You are lecturing.
When you were talking about
I'll give you a
chance. Exactly,
numbers, and you know that those numbers can't be carefully interrogated, and you can't be justifying them. Please give me an opportunity to at least break the silence about that. That's the theme of the conference, and we are talking here about breaking the suffocating silence, which says there is one lockstep view about what is making Africans sick and what can be done to restore them to their health. To that extent, when I had a meeting with the Minister of Health, with Mantho Shabalala Msimang in early December, we talked very quietly and very calmly and rationally about science, about the evidence, and about epidemiology. And it's crucial that we make a distinction between what is called an AIDS case in Africa, which is an epidemiological term, versus the molecular biology or the viral question of an HIV test or HIV antibodies or HIV transmission. The fact that those two get run together and called HIV/AIDS is one of the key things which blinds us and makes us unable to see another point of view about this. And all I think we are saying is that just like with a detective who is trying to solve a crime or a historian who is trying to explain an event, or a doctor who is sitting at the bedside of his patient, we all must look for as many possible explanations as possible. Thabo Mbeki was able to reconcile the irreconcilables. He brought the apartheid rulers and the ANC together. I think, in my opinion, all that he is trying to do here, and it's a very good and very strongly progressive position, is to bring Zaki and Mark Schuetz and the leaders of the AIDS activist community in South Africa with those of us from abroad, those of us who are sitting in California but travel to Africa a lot, who are just as concerned about what is making Africans sick and what can be done institutionally and individually to restore them to their full health.
Dr. Charles Geschechter, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Dr. Geschechter, Professor of African History, Chico State University in California. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In studio, Zaki Akhmat, who is an AIDS activist from South Africa, Mark Schuetz, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on AIDS in Africa. When we come back, we'll be joined by others as well. Stay with us here on Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. As we take on the issue of AIDS in Africa, tiny discussion about a very important and vast issue. Again, in the last few months, a debate has been given new life, reopened, focused on when the South African president, Thabo Mbeki, began a discussion with what is known as AIDS dissidents, people who are questioning how AIDS is caused, whether the virus HIV is actually the cause, whether actually AIDS exists in Africa. Thabo Mbeki spoke with Dr. David Rasnick, who is a biochemist who's worked in the pharmaceutical industry for years. He is on the phone with us now, one of the developers of protease inhibitors, Dr. Charles Geschechter of Chico State University in California. We're in the studio with Zaki Akhmat, an AIDS activist from South Africa, Mark Schoof's reporter. Also with us on the phone is Dr. Fred Wabwiri Mangan, who is director of the Institute for Public Health in Kampala, Uganda. As you hear Dr. Charles Geschechter speak, Dr. Fred Wabwiri Mangan, can you respond to this issue of what is described as AIDS in Africa, an AIDS epidemic in Africa, really can't be separated from, for example, TB and other diseases that people have in Africa? How can it be defined as AIDS?
Thank you very much, Amy. In fact, it was interesting to listen to Dr. Charles Geschechter talk. The first cases of AIDS in Uganda were described in November of 1982. And the reporting officer, who was the district medical officer of Rakai District, a remote district in southwestern Uganda, his typical report was as follows. There is a chronic, debilitating, wasting illness that we are seeing in my district, which has never been seen before in the district. I think that just goes to show you that whereas the clinical case definition of AIDS does have some symptoms and signs which are similar to other diseases like TB, chronic malnutrition, there is a difference. In fact, what Charles mentioned, probably he forgot to mention one thing, that when we talk of chronic persistence fever, we define it for a period of more than 1 month. The diarrhea is chronic and persistent also, defined for a period of more than 1 month. I think the reason why we used a symptom definition to define AIDS in Africa is because we don't have the facilities, or at least initially didn't have the facilities for the lab tests to do a molecular biological definition of AIDS. So in the absence of molecular biological definition or diagnosis of AIDS, the only thing that we had was to come up with a symptom complex which would clearly define a case of AIDS. Now, the case definition was evaluated by a number of studies, looking specifically how specific and sensitive it is, and it was found to be of high predictive value. So I would actually disagree with Charles that what we are calling AIDS is really not AIDS, but some of the other problems.
Dr. David Rasnick, a biochemist, you worked on developing the protease inhibitor. What is your response to Dr. Wabwiri Mangan?
I'm a professional scientist. I've worked in the pharmaceutical industry, as you've said, made these protease inhibitors, and I can read the literature. And I've studied AIDS now from the very beginning, 19 years, and I've determined that there really are four AIDS axioms, that AIDS is contagious, that it is sexually transmitted, that HIV causes AIDS, and that the anti-HIV drugs promote health and well-being. I call those axioms because they are assumed. I've tried to find the evidence that demonstrates that any or all of these axioms are true, and looking at the literature, I cannot find it. These things are all assumed, and they have been assumed since, at least except for the drug aspect, since the very beginning in 1984 when the HIV hypothesis was first put out there. And again, as a scientist, we deal in evidence, just as historians and just as lawyers and I would hope a journalist do. And we have to be skeptical and we have to say, okay, this is fine, it's contagious. Show me where that has been demonstrated. Who are the people that did it? Where did they do it? When did they do it? And Mr. Schoof said that
our criticisms. Actually, I'm a critic of the HIV hypothesis, dissident, that's fine too. He said that it was our positions had been conclusively debunked. And I'm curious to know when, where, and by whom were our questions about the HIV hypothesis conclusively debunked. I certainly haven't been able to find it.
Well, can I ask before that's answered, Dr. David Rasnick, what is your theory about AIDS?
Well, in the United States and Europe, Peter Duisberg and I recently, I should say, published a paper called The AIDS Dilemma, Drug Diseases Blamed on a Passenger Virus. As Charlie Geschechter said, AIDS in Europe and the United States is defined very differently from AIDS in Africa. The only thing really they have in common is the name. And AIDS in the United States and Europe, in our view, is the clinical manifestation of the raging drug epidemic that is present in both places. We, in the United States, we went from a few thousand chronic drug users, I mean like 5-10 years experience of heroin, cocaine, amphetamines, that sort of thing, in the early 70s to around 20 to 25 million chronic drug users in 1989, and that number has gone down about 50% in the early 90s. And interestingly, the entire AIDS epidemic in the United States and in Europe parallels almost exactly the time course of the drug use in both places. The CDC's own statistics, for example, you can get it off their internet website, the HIV-AIDS surveillance report, show that AIDS peaked in the United States in 1992 and has been going down steadily ever since. Now, this was years before the anti-HIV drugs or the cocktails were available. And, of course, when you have the disease peaking at some future point, the consequences of that situation, syndrome, are going to decline as well.
So you're saying that AIDS does not exist?
No, I didn't say that at all.
What are you saying?
I said AIDS is the clinical manifestation of the drug epidemic. It's AIDS is really...
But that is simply not borne out by the facts, David, and you know that that's true. I mean, there have been studies where you look at a cohort of IV drug users. Some of those IV drug users have HIV, and they go on to get the clinical manifestations of AIDS, the reduction in the CD4 counts, and the diseases which then can invade the body because the immune system has been depressed. Whereas those IV drug users who do not have HIV but have similar histories, live in the same communities, use the same drugs, do not get any of the symptoms of AIDS. They do not get a reduction in CD4 counts. They do not get any of the AIDS-defining illnesses. Similarly, let me finish. If you look at homosexual men in the United States and Europe, and there have been numerous studies that have done exactly this, and you look at which ones will go on to get HIV, get AIDS, it is only those who are infected with HIV. The sole predictive indicator of whether a person will get AIDS is HIV. And I also take issue, by the way, that you, when you said that you developed the protease inhibitors, because I actually went on to the National Library of Medicine database and I got a listing of all the studies that you have published. And very few of those studies actually deal with HIV. And of those studies, you are not a lead author in any but a tiny number. And so for you to say that you developed the protease inhibitors, I think is a pretty big exaggeration of your resume.
It's absolutely not. You haven't seen my resume. You think the only protease that exists is HIV protease.
No, I know there are others. You have done work on malaria protease. You have done work on other kinds
and
of protease.
Protease
but I'm
means
talking about
protease
the HIV
means
protease. And protease is an enzyme that is found in many different organisms, including HIV.
Exactly. And I've
Andy,
published,
I just,
and I've spent 25 years.
There was a very good
life.
Point that was made by the doctor from Uganda, which I think needs to be readdressed, and that was he said that he was referring to the province in the southwest part of his country, Rakai province, Rakai district.
Dr. Charles Geschechter.
He mentioned that in 1982, he referred to cases of rampant and uncontrolled diarrhea and wasting and weight loss that he said had never been seen before. It's extremely important that we understand the context in which these observations are being made. 1982 more or less follows a year or two after a decade of a complete and total collapse of the public health system in Uganda under the regime of Idi Amin. There's a very important study from Cambridge University Press by John Iliffe, one of the top historians in the world on Africa from Cambridge University, called East African Doctors. I recommend that anyone who wants to understand the context in which these symptoms that define AIDS...
But Dr. Geschick,
let me just finish my point. In which they occur in East Africa should look as any good progressive dissident or someone who, as the motto of this program is an exception to the rulers, goes and looks at. You will see exactly the context of the decay of hospitals, public health clinics, the absence of even routine kinds of medicines for routine interventions, that Ugandans were suddenly looking sicker and dying in larger numbers in the early 80s, would seem to me to follow logically from the collapse of the public health sector in Uganda.
Let me put that point to Dr. Fred Webwerry-Mangan.
Yes, 1982 was a couple of years after the fall of Idi Amin. However, I completely disagree that this was a reflection of the breakdown of the public health system. True, the system had broken down, but there was clearly a clustering of cases, and this was identified clinically by competent people and verified by other researchers who did a study that was published in the Lancet 1985, Dr. Serwada and colleagues, that showed that this illness was clearly something which had not been in the country before. And even after the public health system began to improve, after the departure of Idi Amin, there have still been cases which can clearly be attributed. And when the test became available, these cases did test positive to HIV infection. So I would disagree that that was a reflection of the breakdown of the system, both economic and public health.
But Dr. Webwerry-Mangan, would you agree that the breakdown of the public health system in Uganda contributes to AIDS infection?
I would not say it contributes to the infection. It could contribute to the gravity of the epidemic because of inadequate health facilities and lack of access of the population to health facilities for treatment for many of the opportunistic infections which come with HIV, like TB. TB and malnutrition are clearly distinct clinical entities which physicians who have been practicing in resource-poor countries can identify. They can diagnose clinically, supported with the basic laboratory infrastructure.
Zaki Ahmed, South African AIDS Act.
I think there are two points that need to address with Dr. Geschick. The first is historical research. I think that at some other point we need to look at what he means when he speaks of Thabo Mbeki initiating negotiations. President Mandela did that from his prison cell, as far as I know, a whole range of other issues like that. But there's two specific things that I want to address. South Africa's healthcare system is not collapsing. In fact, it is getting better. But it is being overwhelmed that 70% of our hospitals have people with HIV. Botswana is the one country in Africa where over the last 20 years there's been consistent economic and social growth. And its healthcare system is not collapsing. People are becoming more stable instead of being a migrant population as they were before. And there is a country which has one of the highest HIV seroprevalence rates in the area and certainly one of the highest number of cases in the region. So there's no correlation between a collapsing public healthcare system and an HIV epidemic, although people like us don't get treated properly when our healthcare systems collapse, and that's the problem.
I would like to address one point that Zaki said about his sister. She had thrush, and she was treated with the thrush therapy, and she got better. She was not treated. He didn't mention anyway that she was treated with the anti-HIV drugs and got better. That's the point that Charlie Geschechter and I are making. Treat the specific symptoms. If you have thrush, treat that. If you're wasting away, feed people. If people have poor sanitation, clean it up. If they don't have drinkable water, fix that. If they have malaria, treat that.
So I have a very simple counter to that. You've probably by now heard of Judge Edwin Cameron, who's the most highly paid civil servant in our country living openly with HIV. A few years ago, he had a viral load of over 150,000. He had PCP pneumonia. He wasn't responding to treatment. I was nursing him. He was getting close to nearly dying. He went on to triple combination therapy. It had what everyone described as the Lazarus effect. He's walking around properly. I have another friend who did not have access to those drugs, Simon Cordy, a great gay and anti-apartheid activist, not one who sits in LA and flies in to do some research, but one who actually fought on the ground there, and he died because he was not on that triple combination therapy. And I tell you that there are many other people, many other concrete examples that I can use. And what we should be talking, and you as progressives, if you call yourselves that, should be talking about is the profiteering of drug companies at people's expense.
I don't dispute that. The thing is that I don't see those Lazarus effects in the scientific literature. I only hear the stories. And I'm a scientist. I have to go by what is documented.
Because every time I go to an AIDS conference, I see numerous studies from numerous labs, from numerous clinics that show a decrease in death rate, an increase in health, after the administration of these triple combinations.
That does it for this program, unfortunately, but I want to give people access to websites and phone numbers if they want more information. We've been joined by Dr. Fred Wabwere-Mangan, Director of the Institute for Public Health in Kampala, Uganda. Mark Schuss, if people want to get a hold of your Pulitzer Prize-winning series on AIDS in Africa, you can go to villagevoice.com. Zaki Akhmat, South African AIDS activist.
www.tac.org.za. And or you can go to the Médecins Sans Frontières, who have been greatly assisting us.
And Dr. Gashakter and Raznik, website you can recommend.
I would say Duesberg.com.
That's
Duesberg.com. And RethinkingAIDS.org. It's all one word, Rethinking AIDS.
I have an email address, fwabwire@imul.com.
And since it is an email address, we'll put all of those on our website at www.democracynow.org or pacifica.org for people to go back through that, as well as other websites as well. That does it for the program, Democracy Now!, produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Special thanks to Robert Knight, Errol Malin, our technical director, Matthew Finch, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!